Morning. Since 1879, the General Assembly has excluded the office of the Lieutenant Governor from those offices the Governor can fill through appointment. And this is for good reason. Under the Constitution, if the Governor vacates his office, the order of succession is a democratically elected Lieutenant Governor, the Senate pro tem, and the Speaker of the House, both of whom are selected by the people's representatives in each House. If, however, the Governor gets to appoint a Lieutenant Governor, the governor's potential successor is no longer the people's choice to succeed to that office. It's one person's choice. The Missouri Constitution provides in Article 4, Section 4, that the governor is authorized to fill all vacancies unless otherwise provided by law. The governor's authority is the default, subject to the limitations set forth by the following clause, unless otherwise provided by law. Since 1879, a statute has existed in one form or another in Missouri that says the governor's appointment authority, or the governor gets to fill vacancies except in the office of lieutenant governor and some other offices. For 140 years, the lieutenant governor's office has been excluded. This interpretation is the interpretation that appellants argue here is supported by the language in the Constitution, supported by the statute that's in effect, and ultimately the Constitution cannot be read in isolation It is limited by its very own terms with the authority vested in the General Assembly. Not only is the plain language of the statute vesting the authority in the General Assembly supported by, well, the plain language, but the history also supports that argument. In the history of the state of Missouri, there have only been two times when a governor has appointed a lieutenant governor until now. And those two times happened in the 1960s and with Lieutenant Governor Joe Maxwell. And in both of those situations, the lieutenant governor was only appointed after being elected to that office. And ironically, the first time with Governor Hearns and after Lieutenant Governor Eagleton vacated his office upon becoming elected United States Senator, William Morris, the Lieutenant Governor, was kept out from the Senate until he was inaugurated, which happened 2 weeks later. In each of these cases, our system has ensured that our Lieutenant Governor, the successor to the most important state in our or the most important elected office in our state, is somebody who has been chosen by the people.
Not for lieutenant governor, but for another position, you're saying?
Pardon? I'm saying to the person who's become lieutenant governor, the successor, potential successor to the office of the governor, should there be a vacancy, has always been somebody who has come there democratically.
Has achieved some other office. Is that? I mean, they haven't, if they're appointed, they obviously weren't elected.
That's correct.
You're saying they were elected to some other office and then from that appointed, or?
Well, so what I'm saying is the lieutenant governor is generally elected. The Senate pro tem and the Speaker of the House, while they are elected to another office, it is the people's representatives in each respective House who decide.
And does the Constitution draw this distinction and say it's okay to appoint people who were Senate pro tem but not others? Because I understand you're making that argument and why you feel it's more comfortable, but I don't see anything in the Constitution that draws these distinctions.
The Constitution says that the order of succession is the lieutenant governor, followed by the Senate pro tem, followed by the Speaker of the House, and then if Jefferson City was hit by a tornado and...
So that person would become governor, but the Constitution doesn't address whether they become lieutenant governor.
That is correct. The Constitution does not address whether they become lieutenant governor.
But you want us to read that distinction into it, is what I'm asking you about. Where do we get that?
Well, the purpose or the argument is that I think that lends support to the office remaining vacant. Because if the lieutenant governor, if the office is vacated and remains vacated, then the successor to the governor is somebody who has come across the position in a democratic manner, appointed by the people's representatives in the House and the Senate. Otherwise, you have somebody who's been appointed to the office of lieutenant governor who becomes the successor, who becomes the potential successor to the office of governor, who has received the support of one person instead of the support of either all of the people or the people's representatives in the respective houses.
If I understand you correctly, you're saying in the history of the state, only twice has an individual has a governor appointed someone to be lieutenant governor. And I think you said in both of those cases, it was someone who had run for lieutenant governor and been elected, but got appointed prior to when the effect of the election would take place.
That's correct. So with Lieutenant Governor Maxwell, when he was appointed, he had already been inaugurated. He had already been elected. So there was a two-month period in between. And although I've had some cases that move quickly in the courts, I don't think that I've had any that move in.
And did anyone challenge those two appointments where it was someone who had been elected lieutenant governor and they were appointed prior to being sworn in as a result of the election?
There was no legal challenge in either of those cases, from the best I can tell. However, had there been a legal challenge, it would have become mooted very quickly, very shortly thereafter, and would have been good reason for the court to not take it up because the person had already been elected to the office.
Of course, the question is what the Constitution provides, and it says unless otherwise provided, and you're asking us to interpret a statute which otherwise provides for other offices but does not provide for lieutenant governor to infer from a negative that they intended to exclude the lieutenant governor.
Well, Judge, it's not inferring from a negative because it expressly excludes that office. As being under the statute, but the Constitution cannot be read in isolation. Because the Constitution, by its very terms, is limited by whatever the General Assembly does.
So, and it says, but you're asking us, and I know you have an argument why this is so, if you could explain it to us, why when it says, as otherwise provided, you're saying because they don't provide in that statute for the Lieutenant Governor, we should infer, we should say that's otherwise being provided with nothing, with a negative. I'm not sure how you avoid that.
Judge, the plain language, if you look at the numerous cases that are cited in my brief, otherwise provided includes stipulating differently. Treating the process differently is otherwise provided. And the question ultimately is, what does the phrase otherwise provide modify? Does it modify the filling of vacancies? Does it modify the governor's power? Does it modify vacancies
generally? What if the legislature had enacted a statute that said the governor can appoint the Secretary of State, and that's all it said? Would that mean that nobody else could be appointed because that was the only one that was mentioned?
No, but if it said the governor can appoint the Secretary of State but cannot appoint some other office, then I think that that office would be excluded. So by the terms of the statute, it is excluding the office. It's not as though Lieutenant Governor is not mentioned in the statute. It is expressly stated in there. And I think the historical context in the state of Missouri, where it has always remained vacant, is important context in this case. And I think that a corollary to that would be the vice presidency. And until the 25th Amendment was passed, the office of vice president remained vacant anytime there was a vacancy. So when Truman became president, there was no vice president until the next election. And that is because the vice presidency and the lieutenant governor, the importance of that office is that it is the people's choice to succeed to the office. Allowing the appointment takes that from being the people's choice to one person's choice.
Before you run out of time, I want to talk to you about standing. The trial court dismissed the petition in part because neither of your clients had standing. And you have pled taxpayer standing. And you're challenging the appointment, the authority of the governor to appoint a lieutenant governor. But your taxpayer standing, the provision in your petition talks about the amount of money, the expenditure of revenue that it would take to fund the office. Shouldn't you be, if you're challenging the authority of the governor to make the appointment, shouldn't you be talking about the expenditure of funds of the governor, by the governor for the appointment, not the future consequences of what it's going to take to run an office?
Well, Judge, taxpayer standing in this state says that if there is an expenditure of funds, then the taxpayer can challenge it.
So was there expenditure? Are you claiming expenditure of funds of the governor's appointment, which is what you're challenging?
Well, it's the action of appointing. So the challenge is to the action of appointing, but as a result of the appointment, there is an expenditure of funds. And in every case that deals with taxpayer standing, it's a challenge to a government action that results in the expenditure of funds. So, for example, in the LeBeau case, it's a challenge to, it was a declaratory judgment challenge to courts in Jefferson County. The expenditure of the challenge is to the legislation, but the expenditure is what happens if the legislation goes through, what happens if the government action is allowed to go forward. And in that case, the government action going forward is results in the expenditure of the funds.
But in all those cases, wouldn't the result of the suit be to prevent that action from going forward? And here, you're not claiming it would prevent anyone from taking office or being in office. You're just saying that you want a declaration there was no power to appoint.
Well, and if there's no power to appoint, then the person who's occupying the office is...
But you withdrew that claim and you withdrew the request for injunctive relief, so that's not part of this suit.
Although it's still a declaration by this court that the appointment was unauthorized, and as this court has stated...
But it would have no effect. You've stated that at least allegedly, you've stated that in open court, that it would have no effect, that no one would be able to do anything with that other than the attorney general or the prosecutor would have to institute a separate action.
Well, Judge, that I would say that's not part of the record, first off, and this is an issue on... This is
Well, we know there's no effect here because you've withdrawn that request that it have an effect.
The injunctive
So the result of what you're doing here is a declaration, and then it's pure speculation on either side what would happen. So,
well, Judge, I disagree with that because it's not a declaration is not unauthorized just because you request no other relief. As the statute sets forth, you can request declaratory relief or you can request other relief, and this court has recently stated in Taylor v. State that inherent in the court's power to grant a declaration is the power of the court to enforce a declaration. The way that...
Even though you've withdrawn your request for injunctive relief, you're asking us to order that in fact such injunctive relief should result from this?
Well, I think that the relief would be a declaration, and what comes from the declaration is that somebody is in the office who's unauthorized. That allows if the person stays in the office, that would allow the parties to go and enjoin the treasurer's office from expending the funds. I think it would require the attorney general to go and enforce this court's order. But ultimately,
Counselor, you're out of time.
All right,
I will save your full time.
Thank you.
Full time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Just turning to that last question, the question of whether or not there was any relief that is being requested in this case at all. The plaintiffs really placed them, they're on the horns of a dilemma here. Because on the one hand, the second argument in our motion to dismiss, and the principal basis for the circuit court's opinion was that seeking any kind of relief that would have legally binding effect on Lieutenant Governor Keough that would force him from office would be an unauthorized quo warranto action because he is now the de facto office holder, at least, even if there's a challenge to his qualifications to hold that office.
Don't we expect the parties and others to abide by court decisions in a declaratory judgment action?
I don't believe if there has been a express, as occurred here, where there is an express repudiation of any claim that he would be bound by that.
Well,
that
the effect of our judgments is a question of law. So what an attorney says in court regarding that effect is not binding on the court, that someone cannot concede a question of law. And so the question of law is, what's the effect of a declaratory judgment? And you're asking us to say a declaratory judgment has no effect.
I don't believe that that's what occurred in the trial court. The finding of the trial court is that at oral argument, they repudiated any request for declaratory relief that would have legally binding effect. And they did that strategically to avoid our argument, which they never addressed in the trial court, that if you were seeking any judgment that would have legally binding effect that could be enforced in any particular way, then this would be a disguised quo warranto action that could not be initiated without the cooperation of the Attorney General or the Cole County prosecutor. So that was the concession that was made. But in a sense, it doesn't matter whether they made that concession or not, because in the reply brief in this court, they're saying, no, we want a declaratory judgment that could be enforced in some way, that could be given legally binding effect in some way. And if that's their position, then they're back on the other horn of the dilemma, which is they've never even addressed, in the trial court, they never once addressed, challenged, or disputed our argument that if they are seeking a judgment that has legally binding effect, they are seeking the ouster of Lieutenant Governor Kehoe from office, and they cannot do that.
You're saying you can't use a declaratory judgment as a backdoor way to get quo warranto?
Exactly right. Exactly right. And more fundamentally than that, even, you can't use a declaratory judgment action as a backdoor method to get an advisory opinion. Because if, in fact, they told the circuit court, which they did, and which the circuit court found and stated in its judgment, they told that we want a judgment that had a declaration of the rights of the parties that has no legally binding effect, would not bind any party, and would leave it strictly to voluntary compliance, that is a textbook, a quintessential advisory opinion. So in the circuit court, they sought only an advisory opinion. In the reply brief in this court, and in their opening brief in this court, they didn't even address our arguments that this is, in fact, a disguised quo warranto action. their ability to dispute that has been waived repeatedly, both in the trial court and in this court. But even if they were there on that other horn of the dilemma, and even if they had disputed that, we presented overwhelming authority indicating that you can't do this. A private litigant can't go into court and challenge the qualifications of a statewide official just on their own motion.
But aren't they challenging not the qualifications of the lieutenant governor, but the authority of the governor to perform this appointment? And how does anyone challenge that if someone questions that authority?
We would say there are two ways that could be challenged, depending on the nature of the state official. And I would say that they're challenging the validity of his service, right? So the qualifications, the challenge to the fact of the appointment and the legal authorization for the appointment is a challenge to their legal entitlement to perform in that office.
And so what are the two ways that it could be challenged?
Two ways. For non-statewide elective officials, it can be done only by a quo warranto action. So that was the holding of the Western District Court of Appeals in the Bene against ABB Power decision. That, for example, the court in that case, relying heavily on this court's cases, said the proper method of challenging the validity of state officer service is in a quo warranto action. Again, the method for establishing that a person has unlawfully held an office is through a quo warranto action. Again, courts will not inquire into an officer's qualifications except in a collateral proceeding in quo warranto. And again, this court held in the Graham against Hurley case that a quo warranto action cannot be initiated by a private relator without the cooperation of a government attorney, and that the discretion of the government attorney, which is either the attorney general or the elected prosecutor, is absolute.
But the statute for quo warranto talks about that the prosecutor and the attorney general shall bring such action if the appointment's unlawful.
It does say the word shall in the statute, but there's a longstanding historical understanding of that that is a discretionary decision made by an executive official. So in other words, there is, and in fact, I believe this court's opinion in Graham against Hurley is unanimous, which said in so many words, the discretion of the government agent is absolute. And actually, the court went a step further and said, it is also the absolute discretion of the circuit court receiving the quo warranto petition as to whether or not they want to receive it. And then the court also emphasized that these are very important protections that prevent there being a cloud over the legality of the conduct of public officials, and also prevent the sort of harassment that might arise if any private litigant could sue any state official at any time and challenge the legality of their service. So that is the one method under Missouri law that's clearly authorized. We say in this particular case where the de facto office holder, and again, they've never disputed that he's at least a de facto office holder. The de facto office holder is one of the sort of five elective executive offices. The sole and exclusive method to remove that person from office is impeachment by the General Assembly. So these litigants, if they want to challenge to test the validity of this officer's service, at the very least, they've got to go to the Attorney General or an elected prosecutor.
But how can you impeach him when he's done nothing that meets the qualifications of impeachment in the Constitution? He's done no misdeeds or wrongful conduct in office. You can't impeach him.
Well, it is an unsettled question whether or not the fact that his appointment is invalid would constitute the kind of misconduct that would lie to impeachment. I absolutely can see that. They may not be able to impeach
him. The lieutenant governor's done nothing wrong.
Well, usurping an office that's not theirs allegedly might or might not qualify?
That would be an argument, and I want to be clear. The Attorney General's office is not taking a position on whether or not that would be appropriate grounds for impeachment.
Very, very wise.
But I would point out, though, that in Moriarty, the logic of this court's decision, in the Moriarty case, the logic of this court's decision was the reason that the sole and exclusive method for the removal of the Secretary of State in that case was impeachment is because Article 7, Section 4 says that officers not subject to impeachment shall be subject to removal in the manner and causes provided by law, which is principally the Quo Warranto statute. So if their position is that he would be removable by the Quo Warranto statute, it must therefore be his position that he could not be impeached. he could not be impeached, even if he did commit, you know, habitual drunkenness and gross misconduct and the various other things that are set forth in Article 7, Section 1.
Did any of the parties in this case seek the Attorney General to issue a quo warranto?
No, the lawsuit was filed the day of the appointment.
Is the record below clear on the fact that they did not seek assistance?
I don't know if there's any specific evidence, but certainly there's no allegation in the petition that we went to the Attorney General's office or we went to the Cole County prosecutor and sought their assistance. So considering the allegations in the petition, there is no statement to that effect, and to my knowledge, it never happened.
Irrespective of whether or not this is quo warranto, or the existence of the statute, the language in the statute, what's the governor's authority to make the appointment?
The governor's authority to make the appointment rises from the plain language of Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution. That says the governor shall fill all vacancies in public offices unless otherwise provided by law. So the governor's authority in this case turns on the question of whether or not the phrase otherwise provided by law means what the state says it means. In other words, the go to the dictionary definitions that were current at the time of the 1945 Constitution. Otherwise means in a different manner, in another way. To provide is to furnish or supply. The immediate context of that provision is talking about the filling of vacancies. Therefore, the ordinary and natural meaning of that language is otherwise provided by law means if the legislature furnishes or supplies another method or another manner of filling that vacancy.
But hasn't that phrase actually been interpreted differently? Because among the list of people that the governor does not have the authority to appoint, according to 105.030, is lieutenant governor, state senators, state representatives. I think there was like a sheriff and a recorder of deeds or somebody. And historically, hasn't the process been when there's been a vacancy for a state Senate seat or a state rep seat that a special election is called or wait till the next election is held and then that seat is filled by the vote of the people as opposed to the governor? I mean, hasn't that how that phrase has been historically been interpreted?
I would say that that's absolutely correct, and these are the exceptions that prove the rule from our perspective, because there is a separate statute that authorizes the manner of filling vacancies in state representative, state senator, and the recorder of deeds of the city of St. Louis, which are the other three offices mentioned in the statute. So our position is if the legislature wants to displace the constitutionally vested authority of the governor in Article 4, Section 4, to fill these vacancies in senior executive offices, it must do so by furnishing or supplying another manner of doing so. Mm-hmm. And as to the other three offices on the list, the legislature did that. We don't know why they never got around to doing it as to lieutenant governor. There's some speculation on the other side here that's unsupported by any evidence. But at the very least, the legislature must speak very clearly if it wants to displace a core executive power. The power to fill executive offices is a core incident of executive power that's vested in the governor by Article 4, Section 4. The legislature would have to speak very clearly if it wanted to displace that, and it has not done that in 105, Section 30 for at least a couple of reasons.
The matter before us is a dismissal. Your comment that evidence has not been presented is contrary to the procedural posture that it is a motion to dismiss.
In that case, I would qualify that by saying no allegations were made in the petition that had anything to do with that particular theory. Now, in the briefing in this court, both sides have relied on internet sources that are outside the evidence. In the sort of motion practice relating to that, we've taken the position
Don't we require the circuit court to determine that we would treat it as summary judgment and give the parties an opportunity to file pleadings consistent with the summary judgment law if we're going outside the actual petition?
I don't think so in this case for two reasons. First of all, I believe that all the materials that we've cited, the party that prevailed in the court below, are, for the reasons we stated in our response to their motion to strike, clearly subject to judicial notice for the purposes for which we cited them. And then secondly,
they're outside the petition, and we give the petition its broadest intendment and would wait to allow the parties to present proof and see if their proof fails on if we're going outside the petition.
And then I would say, in response to that, the second point, which is that that would only come into play if these materials were essential to the decision of the case, and they manifestly are not. The court can resolve this. You know, we cited some internet sources about the history of, you know, the recent history of the opinions of governors. They've cited internet sources as to the history of vacancies.
But again, on a dismissal, we're not to consider any of those. We're simply to look at the sufficiency of the pleading.
The law is clear, I believe, that if matters are subject to proper judicial notice, they may be considered in ruling on a motion to dismiss or an appeal.
It's clear in this case that the trial court didn't rely on
those
by either party, and that the trial court just relied on the allegations and assumed that the allegations by the petitioner were true.
That's absolutely correct. That's absolutely correct. And the court can disregard those sources that either side have cited in the briefing and resolve this case on any of at least four.
Because if in fact we were going on summary judgment, then matters should be filed in writing, and here we don't even have a record of the proceeding.
That is correct. That is correct. But what we do have is the statement in the judgment as to what the concession was that was made in the trial court. But I would emphasize that, in a sense, it doesn't matter, because if their position is we are seeking a legally binding judgment, one that could be enforced by an injunction or by civil contempt order or whatever it would be, then they are confronted with our argument, which they never addressed in the trial court, that is a disguised quo warranto action that is unauthorized.
Would you address the taxpayer standing, the standing of Mr. Cope, pursuant to the allegation, the petition? Mr. Cope alleges he has taxpayer standing because the appointment will require the expenditure of revenue collected by the taxpayers to fund the office of Lieutenant Governor. Is that sufficient for taxpayer standing when challenging the appointment authority?
No, it is not sufficient, and in fact, that was an alternative basis for the circuit court's holding that Mr. Cope lacked taxpayer standing. They relied heavily on the LeBeau case in this context, but I would point out that the fundamental principle that's advanced in the LeBeau case is that the taxpayer standing, the taxpayer's legally protectable interest, which you need to have standing, is in the proper use and expenditure of taxpayer dollars. And then the airport tech case that we cited in our brief says that, look, taxpayer standing is not a passport to explore the legality of any sort of government program. So the idea is, well, we've got some government program, there's some money being spent somewhere, therefore you can have taxpayer standing to challenge everything that happens before that money is spent in the program and after the money is spent in the program. I don't think that the LeBeau case can be read that broadly.
What should have been alleged to have granted taxpayer standing?
I believe the appropriate thing to do, which I think would have been clearly the most appropriate way to establish taxpayer standing, would have been to name the state officials in charge with disbursing money, in other words, the treasurer and the Office of Administration, as defendants, and to seek as relief a declaration or injunction prohibiting the expenditure of tax dollars. That was not done in this case, and it's clear why it wasn't done, because, of course, Lieutenant Governor Keogh could keep serving in office, even if they weren't giving money to his office. So they clearly wanted much broader relief.
Would that money have included his salary?
I think so.
Because that's a direct expenditure required by his appointment.
I think that would be the very natural thing for a taxpayer to challenge that and the other incidents of his office that would not be spending if it were merely being maintained administratively while it was.
But your point is that really that's not the taxpayer's suit is not the proper suit to even bring. The only way to challenge this is quo warranto.
Absolutely correct. I would say that as well. Even if they were doing that, keep in mind that the whole, Mr. Chief Justice, my time has expired. Very briefly, what the Benny case says, and I think its reasoning is compelling, is not just that you may not seek to oust someone from office in a private litigation, but it says that you may not test the validity of their service in that office if you were merely a private litigant in litigation. So they lack taxpayer standing, but even if they had it, they would still be confronted by the quo warranto problem.
Counselor, I understand Judge Wilson has a question for you.
Before you sit down, it seems to me that if you are right and quo warranto is the sole remedy, or at least there's no private remedy, then it seems that this is not a case that involves title to state office, and therefore it's not within this court's exclusive appellate jurisdiction.
It's a great question. I thought about that in writing the response to the jurisdictional statement, and by analogy, what was in my mind were the cases that hold, for example, if there are alternative bases, for example, to challenge the constitutionality of a state statute, and even if the case could be resolved of on a ground that doesn't relate to the validity of the statute, this court would still have jurisdiction. I think by analogy, that should apply here, because if they were to somehow prevail, which they should not do, but if they were to somehow to prevail in all their arguments, at some point they do want to.
Our cases say if you allege something that would invoke our jurisdiction, you don't have to win because you're not going to retroactively take away jurisdiction once it vested.
Absolutely, I agree.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I'd like to respond to a point that Judge Russell brought up, which is asking the state how this action could be brought. And the result of the state's answer is that the state believes there's no ability to challenge this aside from folks who, by the Attorney General's appearance in this case, obviously would have no interest in or reason to challenge.
How do we know that since you don't even allege that you asked them to?
Well, Judge, I think that they're simple. Their presence in this case shows the lack of interest, but ultimately that's a quo warranto action. And
Who would defend the action other than the Attorney General that you brought?
Well, I think
why would they not have the obligation to defend this case?
If they had an obligation to bring the action, then I think that they would be conflicted out of defending the case and they'd have to find somebody else to defend it. And that happens frequently when there's one branch of government suing the other and they have to choose which side they're going to be on.
Right. But often that comes with a request from both sides.
It may, and I can't speak to that, Judge.
But the point is, once you've sued, of course, it's their obligation to defend the office holder. So how does that prove anything other than they're performing that duty?
Well, I think that
I understand quo warranto to the extent, if opposing counsel is right, it would be within their discretion whether to bring it, and you're saying that's not an adequate remedy for the people, but is it the one that's provided by law?
Well, and the answer to that question, I would say, is no. It's not, well, it may be a remedy, but it is not the only remedy. And in the context of declaratory judgment, this court stated in the Manzara case cited on page 14 that the taxpayer's interest in the litigation ultimately derives from the need to ensure that government officials conform to the law. Public policy demands a system of checks and balances whereby taxpayers can hold public officials accountable for their acts. Taxpayers must have some mechanism of enforcing the law.
So can taxpayers bring quo warranto actions or backdoor in quo warranto actions for any office holder if the Attorney General or prosecutor fails to do so?
Well, I think that a quo warranto action is a separate cause of action. Here we're dealing with the declaratory judgment. And ultimately, what in the declaratory judgment...
Then we should infer the office holder has to leave office if you're successful. So why don't you now address their argument that that's a disguised quo warranto action?
Well, Judge, because a quo warranto action, I think, is... it would be telling the office holder to get out of the office. And ultimately, this is a declaratory judgment that is asking for a declaration of the law that the appointment was unauthorized. And to bring a declaratory judgment action, this court has held time and again that you have to have taxpayer standing, you have to have standing, and the controversy has to be ripe. There are no other restrictions on that. And in this case, we've alleged taxpayer standing, and the claim is obviously ripe because there is an appointment. That is the distinction between a declaratory judgment and an advisory opinion. So they are simply separate causes.
Did I misunderstand you earlier? Because I thought you'd said then the lieutenant governor would have no choice but to leave office, which is what I thought was the basis on which opposing counsel is arguing. If that's your position, it's effectively seeking quo warranto.
No, I think that the office holder would be in a difficult position. I think that what would happen is, after this court's declaration, if the office holder took any actions, then the third parties would not be able to rely on it, which is what the Ben case ultimately deals with in a de facto office holder situation, is whether third parties can rely on the government official, whether they are the de facto office holder. And in this case, the court's declaration would result in third parties not being able to rely on them.
Thank you.
Councilor, before you sit down, I don't want to interpret your silence to mean that you did concede, but the question direct to you, as I did to opposing counsel, was did you or any of your clients ask the Attorney General to seek a quorum orator based on the arguments that you've put forth in your declaratory judgment petition?
I did not personally ask. I can't speak to anybody else, but I will say there were numerous public statements supporting their position, and ultimately we didn't file a quo warranto. We filed a declaratory judgment. I think they're separate causes of action. The parties are entitled to bring the separate cause of action, the appellants in this case, based on this court's precedent. And so I think that the action was proper.
Thank you.
Thank you.